The Jay Young Show is a weekly podcast featuring insightful discussions with anyone from big business CEOs, celebrities, to military heroes. Each interview is a personal conversation about business, life, and anything in between. And now, your host, Jay Young.
Hey, everybody. Jay Young, King Operating. This is the Jay Young Show. I tell you what, I have a great guest today. One of my dear friends, James Webb, wrote a book about redneck resilience. I mean, just if you see that title, what would you be thinking in the very beginning if you thought, what is a redneck resilience? Well, we're going to talk about James today. And I tell you what, I read the book. I loved it. And I couldn't get enough of it. And there's been a lot of people that I've heard when they start, they don't finish. I mean, they finish that book. I mean, they're like, man, this is great. And it is definitely a page turner. James Webb is being extremely transparent in his life, tells you personal things that, you know, I knew, but I didn't think James would tell the world, you know, and he tells everybody about his personal life and his business life, his successes and where he's going in the future. He's not finished yet. He's going to continue on and tell you what. James, thanks for being on today.
Thank you, brother. I really appreciate it. It means a lot.
Absolutely. We're going to have a great time. And I'll tell you, this is going to be one of those. You know, this program is for the 16 to 20 year olds of people that want to, you know, think about what do they want to do in life. They're in that high school, college, their decision making. Where do they want to go from here? And that's what this is all about. I mean, man, if you know, if there's anybody that you want to make sure that you think about and try hard, you keep on, it's going to be you. So, James, I'd like for you to do. If you will, just kind of give us some of your background, where you grew up. We're going to talk about where you grew up. We're going to talk about, you know, some of your challenges and then obviously, you know, the resilience part of it. But kind of tell us about your background.
Sure. Love to do that. Little country boy. Grew up in South Mississippi, a little town called Laurel, Mississippi, to two teenage parents that fell in love a little too young and didn't have a whole lot to give us but love. But love they did. And my dad became an electrical apprentice at the local electrician shop. And the owner there gave us a little tiny, about 900 square foot house to live in. Five tiny little memories of that as a child. And life kind of revolved around church, Cub Scouts, and Little League Baseball. That was pretty much my life growing up until I got to be a teenager. And my dad worked all the time. Didn't see him a lot growing up as a kid because he was just out there working, making a living. I remember his first job was 50 cents an hour. I still remember that. And my mom stayed home and took care of us. And then sure enough, they had two more boys and I had two brothers. And growing up in the Deep South, went through the segregation period of time, came out of that, junior high school, been on my own since about 16 or so. And, you know, talk about it in the book a little bit about when I started working early at 5 years of age and all sorts of crazy stuff. But great life in South Mississippi, no complaints, raised by beautiful parents and very lucky that way.
That's great. What was it, do you think, you know, because you were selling, what was it you were selling at an early age?
Yeah, at the church bazaars, everybody was selling everything from used clothes to candy and I got the idea with my mom to make potholders.
Potholders. That's right. That's right. Potholders. Okay.
So 5 years of age, I started making potholders.
Yeah. So you found out exactly earlier, real early about how much it costs and how much you can sell it for and the idea of a profit. So you found that out at an early age.
Yeah. I knew a couple of things pretty early. One was if I wanted it, I had to go get it myself. There just was a lot of money going around. And two, I learned a little bit about saving money. And so I did potholders for 2 or 3 years, saved up that money, and then eventually bought my first lawnmower when I was probably 8 years old at the local, what was then Gibson's Discount Center, which is now Walmart. And that's how my little lawn mowing career started.
Wow, that's awesome. So you're already making money in such an early age. What do you think drove you? Did you want things or did you just think, okay, well, I want to make money? What was it at such an early age?
Yeah, you know, it wasn't a making money thing per se, but I can always remember, and I've always said this, that I always wanted more. I always wanted more, as long as I remember.
Right. Always wanted more. And so you were just like, okay, well, if I want more, then I've got to go out and get it myself. And I'm not going to wait on somebody else to hand it to me, or just wait for somebody. Because if that happened in your shop, you'd never, in your home, you'd never get it, right?
Yeah.
You know, 900 square feet. Yeah, exactly. So, I mean, if you're in a 900 square foot house, I mean, I'm sure you and Kathy have a closet that big these days, you know, but probably more than one closet that big. But so growing up, and then you graduate high school, and then you go to a college, right? You go to junior college.
I did go to junior college. It was I'd been working at the local print shop. I became actually running a printing press through high school, and a cute side story was the minister of music at our church gave me a half scholarship to sing in the college choir.
Wow. That's great.
I went to junior college and then unfortunately got sick the first quarter. That's almost died with a couple of tumors, but that all got taken care of. And then sang in the junior college choir. And then just one day by pure accident, walking through the campus science building and saw a mimeograph sign that said, I'm interested in x-ray technology, called Liz Bush. And I thought, x-ray technology? What the heck? Why not? And so lo and behold, I got into the x-ray tech program.
And that was at the very beginning of all this. Is that right? Or had it been going on several years before that? Or is this brand new?
No, I'm literally, I had just turned 18 years old when I was accepted into the x-ray tech program. I started first grade at 5 years of age. I was always a year younger than everybody in my class.
Right.
Started college at 17 instead of 18.
Right.
And it was a 2-year program. I call it a 2-year slave labor program because it was based at the hospital. And you basically work 18 to 16 hours a day for 2 years learning to become an x-ray technician.
Right. Wow. So then after that, you're working for other people. You talk about in your book about different relationships and resilience is two of your big words, is relationships that you've developed. And let's talk about relationships a little bit. You met Barry or who was your biggest mentor or person that you would say, hey, I want to be like that person growing up in that very beginning stage?
Yeah, you know, we didn't have a ton of what I would call capitalist role models, business role models. I didn't really know the rich people in town so well. And so a lot of my initial role models were more about just caring and human people. I talk about Miss Love in the book. Miss Love was an African-American lady teaching in a 99% white school. She was the only African-American teacher in the entire school district. Mm. And she's the first teacher that ever I really thought cared. And I caught on to that and followed her. And then certainly my choir director pointed me in a certain direction. Funny side story about him, where I'm throwing the football one day in the church front yard, and he comes up and says, hey, can I play with you guys? And we all start laughing because he's the choir director. How the heck could he even throw a football? And he reaches back and throws a perfect spiral down the field. It turns out he was an All-American high school football player. And so I learned really quick not to judge people by what they did.
Right.
Barry came a little later in my life. He came after sort of the going back to college I did at nights and getting sort of in the hospital chain where I was going to be a hospital administrator. And then Barry's the one that kind of took me out of the clinical side of medicine and into the business side of medicine.
I got you. Okay. All right. So you went to work for other people. How long do you think that was that when you worked for somebody else? How much of your career?
Yeah. So I was 30 years old. I was a vice president of a company. We were the largest mobile MRI company back in those days, back in the mid 80s. We put MRI scanners in trucks and took them between hospitals because hospitals didn't have them then. And I'll never forget it, sitting in a corner office overlooking downtown Dallas, thinking I'm hot stuff at 30 years of age with two assistants and a bunch of people working for me. And the phone rang and they said, Mr. Webb, we've just sold the company. The chair you're sitting in needs to be vacant. You're fired. It was that quick.
Wow.
That sent me off on a different direction right there.
So you started that. So it was about 10 years. Was it 10 years that you worked for other people to get your, to get handle on everything and learn the ropes, if you will?
Yeah. Even after that, I had to work for someone else to get to the next level. And so I ended up in South Florida, was president of a company down there that did imaging centers. So now we had the machines, not in the trucks, but inside the buildings and doing outpatient imaging. And got one of those little crazy things where a doctor I knew came up and said, "Hey, I want your company to build me an MRI center in Trinidad and Tobago." And I thought, there's no way this company's going to do that. So I went to my boss, the chairman of the company, and said, "I need two things. I need you to fire me so I can exercise my severance package, and I need you to be my first investor." And that was 1996 when I started my first company.
Wow. Okay, so 1996, after these years, because a lot of times it's hard to become, I mean, I know you had it. You talk about, you go all in, but you don't have everything knowledge-wise on this building, this big company that you did and sold it later in life. But so, you know, I mean, a guy told me one time that you should work for another company for 5 years just to kind of get a base and a foundation of everything to make sure that you understand it. And know everything there is to know before you kind of jump out there on your own, which some people do, some people don't. I mean, would you have done anything different? Looking back now, would you have done anything different in your career? Would you have worked for somebody longer or shorter?
No, not really. I think if there was anything that I really came out of that, it was building the relationships and the reputation in the industry. You know, our industry is, many companies are expensive, but building MRI centers is a $3 or $4 million project. So for someone to come out of high school and think they're going to raise that kind of money is kind of unbelievable. So I had a reputation. I had connections. I knew people and was able to get people to fund my first project. And it probably took me that 13, 14 years to build that reputation, to build those relationships so that I could go to a particular finance company and go, "I need $5 million. And they go, "Okay." Signature only.
Yeah. Not too many people that if you skip college and you think you're hot stuff and you go, "Hey, I think I'm just going to go over here and borrow $5 million." And no, it's not going to happen. I mean, unless you have a Jones on the back end of your name or something or whatever. But so I think that's great. I think that it did take that long to establish a track record for yourself, for what you do and how you do it, and also to establish those relationships, because it takes those kind of relationships to access that kind of capital to get this thing started and to start. So you started Preferred Imaging at 96?
Actually, at that time, I did what was called Paradigm Healthcare, and that's when I went out of the country. I left, lived in Boca Raton, Florida at the time. Travel predominantly and all over Latin America, all over the Caribbean, building imaging centers and cath labs, and got crazy stories in the book about being held at gunpoint by the Sandinistas and almost kidnapped by the Guatemala rebels and all sorts of other silly stories. Something that I love doing, got a lot of experience, but at some point was starting to have family then and realized that was a cool thing to do, but probably not a smart thing to do. And I sold that company in 2000.
And then 2000, okay.
Preferred Imaging.
And yeah, a little bit of money that you put toward Preferred Imaging, and then you started Preferred Imaging. And then from there, it was, so you worked in that business and grew that by having multiple Preferred Imaging x-ray places in around the country. About how many did you have total?
Yeah, we ended up being with 28.
28, okay.
Largest provider in Texas.
Right.
Patient imaging services.
Okay. That 28 there. And then I love the story about, you know, talking about Kathy and talking about going to Africa and having all this, you know, wait a minute. What? I mean, so you know, this guy's getting ready to pretty much just sell your company or give your company away or give it to private equity people. And you got to go into that story a little bit about what would have happened. So you're in Africa with Kathy on a family trip that you planned your entire lifetime, pretty much. And you get an email or a phone call and it says, "So your partner at the time is going to sell your company, do something." So you said, Kathy, got to go. And not even changing clothes. You get back on the plane and you fly and land and all this. But what would have happened if you wouldn't have made that decision to come back?
You know, I don't know, but I'll back up just a tiny step and say that, you know, we started with one facility, then two, and kind of built a reputation we had a belief that we wanted to be the Neiman Marcus of medical imaging centers. We wanted to be the best, the prettiest, the cutest. We just built that, and we branched off into pain management and did 53 of those partnerships. We branched into toxicology. And so around 2015, we thought, hey, it's about time to sell. We'd gotten some offers. We looked at different things. And we got close to the dance floor, and then the deal blew up.
$140 million
blew up. And there's several reasons I think it blew up, but it did. And I'd had planned this trip with my son. It was his high school graduation trip, a 3-week safari in Africa. And we're over there. And I get the phone call in the middle of the safari that, hey, you know, those private equity guys, managed care guys we're working with, I think they can probably run this company better than you. And I'm going to invite them over here for a meeting with all our staff. And the fun part about most of that was it wasn't legally possible because I still had the controlling votes. This was much more of a moral issue, much more of a motivation issue for my team because they were freaking out. Believe it or not, you still get internet in Africa. So I was getting texts and phone calls and really kept track of the whole thing all the way on a 36-hour trip back from the middle of nowhere to Dallas, Texas. Cute side story, made the meeting they were having. Barged in the door with my driver, who was about 6'4". 300 pounds, and I told him I'd do nothing but look mean and sit in a chair. And so he did, and I took over the meeting and kicked out the guys that were there. Nice. It wasn't their fault, really. My partner and I met afterwards. I was too mad to talk to him, but we kissed and made up. We had to eventually to get the company back together. Yeah. I just think he got scared. I think he got motivated by the thought that maybe he could fix the deal. That wasn't his thing. It was a fun thing to do in retrospect, but at the time it was brutal.
Right. Wow. What a story. I mean, that's a defining moment. I know in your life and no telling, you know, because I've dealt with private equity companies that some people have, and they're not fun. I mean, they don't care about the equity owners. And I mean, they're out for themselves, you know, so no telling what would have happened.
Yeah, they. It was a bit of a shock to me. I initially heard it before Africa, and it had been a few months since they had sort of pulled out of the deal, but it caught me by surprise when they pulled out. And again, I think I know why. I probably won't mention it, but I think I could kind of figure out why they did it. Did the thing with my partner, and then we all got together as a group and sat down with our employees a few weeks later once I got through being pissed off. We called, kissed and made up and rebuilt the company. And then the next time I learned a valuable lesson, which was I hired an investment banking firm to take us to market, not try to do it ourselves.
Right.
And so then we sold the company in 2017.
Wow. Wow, what a great story. What a great story. Congratulations on that. I know that was a big win for you and your family, for sure. For sure. And I tell you what, before we get to Orange Theory, which I'm amazed at that story about that, I want to talk a little bit, if you will, about your you go through a divorce, as you mentioned in the book, you talk about it. You're very, like I said, you're very, very transparent, which is awesome. It just tells, and I know everybody out there needs to listen to this. I mean, you know, James doesn't do this for him. This isn't a hey, look at me type of scenario for James. James is doing this for you. He wants you to use this book to your advantage, to talk to your friends and family about, or a kid or whatever, and just know about resilience and about relationships and getting to the end and having fun in life. Man, James is all about, you know, having fun and talking to people and being, you know, just there for other people. And James has been a great friend to me. And I know a lot of the Tiger 21 guys that we're involved with, but I tell you what, it's just a great, great time. And I know that you know, one of the things that really, you know, that I remember about your story when you first told me about it several years ago, you know, you're like, well, yeah, you know, and you didn't tell about your divorce, but you told me about, you know, your wife, ex-wife, I'm sorry, deceased wife, talking about her in that story, man. And I mean, the things that not only that she goes through, but the things that you go through as well, you know, trying to help her. And during this time, so is this, okay, so you unfortunately talk about your divorce, you have kids, and then you talk about Marcia in your book. And I know I'll get emotional about this because I love your love for her, but I also love Kathy's love for her and knowing all about it. I go to your house and there's pictures of Marcia there and the kids and you and Kathy. I mean, it's like, you know, she understands it's part of life and it's part of your heart. Mm-hmm. So kind of talk to me about Marcia.
Yeah, let me do that because that's probably the single most influential person in my life. If you want to talk about who was most influential in my life, was Marcia. So married very young, had a beautiful daughter. Marriage fell apart after 10 years. We were just not on the same page. Parted ways, moved to South Florida. I did what you're not supposed to do. I fell in love with an employee. And so I met Marcia. She was in the sales department. I was the president of the company. And we worked together for a while, and that led to romance. And then we sort of came out to the owners and made sure they were cool with it and the rest of things. And she lived in Chicago. I lived in South Florida. So we had a 3-year romance distance wise. And then she came to Florida. We were married. She took care of the boys. We had 2 children, Max and Joe, and moved with me from Florida to Texas when we started Preferred Imaging, and really just kind of took the mantle of the family. That's what she did. She recognized that I had to go work. And when I say work, I'm talking the 15 hours a day, 6 days a week. In fact, there's a cute story that I gave her a kiss on the cheek and said, I'll see you in 5 years. I got to go to work. And she was such a trooper, always there for me. And then, you know, we finally made it around 2005. We started making money. 2006, it was crazy money. 7, 8, 9, 10. We had some really, really prosperous years. And we're sitting in the plane flying back to Chicago and sitting in first class drinking a champagne, kind of reminded me of that day I was sitting in that Dallas office and I got fired and thinking I'm, you know, top of the chain. And she says, I have a stomach ache. And we stop at the local ER clinic, and we did. And 48 hours later, stage 4 pancreatic cancer confirmation, no symptoms, no signs, completely changed my world, the entire family's world, obviously hers. I turned the company over to the different people that were running it and said, I'll see you guys when this is over. I'm an x-ray technician by training, obviously. And in that ER, I looked at the images they took, the CT scan and x-ray, and I knew immediately what was going to happen. I didn't have anybody to tell me. Mm. But I tried to stay positive and stayed with her. And we ended up, we went all the world looking for answers, but we ended up at MD Anderson in Houston. And on May 20th of 2012, they dismissed her from the practice and gave her about 30 days to live. And on the very sad drive back home, I suddenly got a sharp pain in my back and diagnosed myself with a kidney stone and got her home, put her to bed, tucked the boys in, made sure they were safe with the nanny. And then I went to the hospital and I didn't have a kidney stone. I had a tumor the size of a baseball, and I had a renal cell carcinoma, potentially stage 3. And got home. So I remember sitting in my driveway talking to God, going, what are you doing to my family? I just couldn't get it. I still don't know the answer to that one this day. And met with doctors for myself, arranged hospice for Marcia, and just decided to forego the chemo and the radiation. I didn't have time for it. And I just told them, cut me open and take it all and leave me alone. And they did. And I walked out of the hospital in 19 hours and went home to take care of her. And she made it 6 more days. Died with me holding her and the boys holding her hands. And her family was there. And then I just spent the summer with my boys trying to get our head on straight and get ready for our new life. And my sense of grieving had started way before everybody else's, back when I saw those first x-rays I knew what was happening. So I was, you know, at a place to kind of begin the next chapter of my life. And I knew the bar scene went for me. And as male chauvinistic as this might sound, I knew that a guy with a couple of bucks in his pocket, you know, would be a target. And I had two little boys to worry about. So I signed on to Match.com.
Wow. Wow. Signed on to Match.com. And then you forgot about it. Or two, three months later, you decide, oh, yeah, hey, there's that Match.com that I've been at the Atlantis. And then you went back on, and all of a sudden, there she is, right? I mean, there, Miss America, there she is. So you're meeting Kathy.
Yeah. I often say, you know, I don't see a lot of things coming in life, and I didn't see Kathy coming. I was literally just playing on Match.com, and if anybody's familiar with it, it's called winking, and she winked at me.
Well,
and we back, and we started the texting and the emails, and then I was very cautious about it because of my boys and because of Marcia's family, and we went on our first date, and as I said, in our wedding vows, it was my first date in 20 years and the last first date for the rest of my life.
Wow.
I didn't have to look anymore, and we kept our dating secret for probably 3 or 4 months, and then I introduced her to my boys, and then Marcia's family, who I love like my own to this day, introduced her to them, and they accepted her. In fact, they call her their daughter-in-law now, and we dated a total of 3 years, and we're married in a big old wedding at the Four Seasons, and had a lot of fun, and we've been having a blast ever since.
That's awesome. That is awesome. And then the most humbling experience in this whole, I mean, she accepts Marcia, understands your love for her, and doesn't get jealous or mad or whatever about, you know, that part of your life. Cause that was obviously a very important part of your life, you know? So she's fine with everything.
Yeah. I've often said this to Kathy, I can't do what you do.
Yeah.
Her embrace that, her be part of that. As Jay mentioned, there's a picture of Marcia still in our house, a big picture. And it'll be there until my boys finish college. That's the commitment. And Kathy was big into menorahs. Kathy was Jewish. I was Southern Baptist. That's a whole different story. So Kathy's gotten into menorahs, and she holds a Hanukkah dinner every year for the family, and, you know, just sort of accepted it all and became part of our collective now, really four families that we've all sort of come together. And she had two beautiful daughters that I love as my own now. And one's married, one has a very nice boyfriend, and they're good girls, and they blended with my three children, and it's quite the little success story.
Wow. That's great. What a good sized family. What a good sized family. And you love that. I mean, you love family and relationships, and being a part of having all the kids over. And I'm sure Thanksgiving is just one of the best in the world, or Christmas. I mean, all the different holidays are just unbelievable for you. And I know you're very happy during that time. That's awesome. What a great story, James. I'll tell you, that is just that is really great. I appreciate that. So what I like to do is, if you don't mind, just kind of finish up with the Orange Theory, because, man, talking about somebody that walks into a place, the Orange Theory, hearing about Orange Theory. So kind of tell us about the Orange Theory story. What happened? How did you ever get to know about this, and why did you do it?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's one of the funniest stories of all, because I'm in Florida on a business trip, bring Kathy along, having dinner with some friends. And one of them says, hey, have you ever heard of Orange Theory Fitness? And I use those famous words, which I'll take it easy on this one. What the hell is Orange Theory Fitness? And Kathy looked into it and said, this is kind of a cool concept. So I took the class myself the next morning in Boca Raton, Florida. And I thought the class was cool. I thought the people were nice, but what caught my attention was the trainer. And I've said these words a lot: she bled orange.
Wow. Okay.
That's passion. And I like people that are passionate about their products. And so my initial way of proposing, and Jay, I did a better job later, but my initial way of proposing to Kathy was, I'll buy you three franchises if you'll quit your job and move in and take care of me and my boys and run these three franchises. And that lasted about 3 or 4 months. And then Orange Theory called me personally. They were in the growth mode then. They only had about 100 gyms at the time. Now they have close to 2,000. and said, we want to sell you a territory, which is, for those in the franchise world, it's about territories, not about buying franchises. And so we ended up buying most of the Dallas-Fort Worth territory and then eventually got the rest of it brought in with a merger. And over the next 5 years, built 33 Orange Theory Fitness gyms across North Texas. And having learned about, you know, banking, I hired an investment banking firm, Fifth Third Bank. I said, take us to market. We're ready. And we had 70 interested parties, 19 letters of intent. It was crazy. Settled on one company and closed that deal December of 2019, 2 months before the pandemic. And it wasn't planned. It was just flipping luck.
Right, right. Well, so you knew the pandemic was coming.
No, I did.
Yeah, I mean, that's an amazing story. I remember when you sold, I remember thinking about it, like right after that, you said something in one of our meetings and you said, oh yeah, well, I mean, and I was like, oh my gosh. I mean, March, April, May would have been dead. I mean, these people are like, what do we get ourselves into, you know, with this Orange Theory? Because, you know, the fitness world, obviously during that time just went to nothing. And then I'm sure it's now it's perfect and they're back to normal, but what a hit. What a hit at the very beginning.
They did get smashed hard, and I give the group a lot of praise because they were great. They still had some other obligations. We maintained the territorial rights, and they had to buy 8 more gyms from us over a period of time, and they did that even though they didn't open them. They still bought the franchises from us. They did the right things. I have a lot of respect for that group. It's back. I'd say it's probably back at about 70% capacity right now. I still keep track of them because, as I said, we're still the area manager. We just don't own the gyms.
I got you. Okay. Well, that's good. I mean, you're still involved in that. You're going to grow that. Are you thinking about more than just the Dallas area, or are you in charge of more than that? I mean, if I was Orange Theory, I'd say, hey, you hear about this redneck resilience guy out of Dallas, James Webb? I'm going to sign him up. So have they wanted you to get more involved in the whole entire project, or is this just, hey, I got Dallas, I'm good, don't bother me, you know?
We're Dallas Fort Worth. I have a partner, the guy that originally owned Fort Worth that we merged with. He and our good friends and good partners, and that's kind of it. Every other territory has been bought by another private equity group, and now we're watching the private equity groups merge them together. I personally think that they'll merge this whole thing under one group to keep it massively private, or maybe eventually do an IPO. We'll see.
Yeah, yeah.
But we went off in a different direction, and you know me, I can't stop what I'm doing. So we went off into another franchise because I like the franchise model. As I've gotten older, I don't want to do startups anymore. And we bought most of the rights to Texas from a group called Be Balanced, which had the exact same characteristics Orange Theory did, only this is in the homeopathic hormone weight loss space. And predominantly for women. And we made a commitment to do 20 stores across Texas. And we've got 3 open right now and about to do another 3 this year. And then I think pandemic hurt us a lot. You know, as lucky as I was to get out of Orange Theory, getting into a retail weight loss program during the pandemic, probably not the best move, but coming out of the pandemic, a lot of us, including me, put on a few pounds. So I think it'll catch fire here pretty quick, and we'll probably look for kind of the same sort of strategy, a 5-year plan.
Wow, that's awesome. That's great. Be Balanced. So that's the Be Balanced centers. There's 3 in Dallas. Now you say?
There's actually 4 in Dallas. There's a gentleman, nice gentleman, that has a store himself.
Okay.
And I hope to buy him out eventually, but right now we have 3. He has 1. I think there's only about 35 stores nationwide. They're a young franchise. I've gotten to know the owners real well personally, like them a lot, trying to help them a little bit too. And I think it was a big deal for them to be able to kind of market Be Balanced Center has Orange Theory Fitness' largest franchisee, James Webb. So it was kind of an ego moment too for me, but also I think it helps them with their product.
Right. Well, that's great. That's great. So that's your next move. That's your next move, is to Be Balanced. So we need to make sure that we talk about that and advertise that a little bit on our reviews with you, because we want to make sure people buy that book, buy the book and learn learn what it takes and, you know, talk about you. I mean, talk about the relationships, you know, that you had throughout the book that I love to read. They're great. You look for the best in people. You know, you're not looking for the bad in people. You're looking for the good, and you're optimistic and if you get bad news, which, hey man, your life has been, I mean, there's like all of us entrepreneurs, right? I mean, it's like you get hit so bad, a lot of people would just stay down. But that's all about the resilience part of it, is that, hey, you know what? Find the optimistic things and keep going. I mean, you got into this for a reason in the beginning, and just because you got a little knockdown, I mean, it's not that you want to stop. You want to keep going, you know?
Absolutely.
Make sure you work hard. Know that there was, you know, when you're exhausted, make sure you send out 2 more emails, right? When you think you can't do anymore, send out 2 more emails or do something to keep it all positive. So, anything that they didn't teach you at Jones County, you know, what was you and your son's favorite saying about Jones County College, what they didn't teach you at Jones County College?
Yeah, it's a funny thing that happened many years ago. I used to always say when I was talking to my family and my kids, well, they didn't teach me that at Jones County Junior College, because you learn most of your business lessons not from college. And my little 12-year-old son said, Dad, you need to turn that into a drinking game. So for fear of going to jail, I might be the only human being on the planet that ever did a tequila shot with his 12-year-old son.
So,
the thing with the family.
Yeah. Talk about James being transparent. James, you are pretty transparent. So that's great. So anything that I haven't talked about that you want to bring up before the end of this, you know, I know you want to talk about resilience and not quitting and staying hard and don't give up type deal. And you want to talk about relationships and about your family, the love you have for your family and all the, I mean, which is just, I mean, to me, being a family man, that's what I look at you and I think about you and your relationship with Kathy and your kids and you know, I know it goes beyond that, which I don't know your relationship with all your different partners, but I've heard you say it and talk about it, but I don't know that personally, but I tell you, just the people that you're around and the people that, I mean, if James Webb's going to have a party, I mean, then you don't have to put up too many antennas, man. I mean, there'd definitely be a lot of great people that come. So that's great. But is there anything else that you'd like to bring up at the very end to conclude?
No, I think I'll just share with you just a few tiny little lessons and then we can kind of wrap it up and I'll give you the website for the book and all that sort of stuff. But, you know, you talked about it earlier, I work harder than anybody else. It's so important. Do that extra email, do that extra thing, make that commitment to time. And this is not anything James Webb invented, but we do not learn from our successes. We learn from our failures. And I think a lot of people fail and then they get depressed and you got to sit back, take a second, look at it. Why did you fail? What happened? Fix it and go on forward. And then I've had this philosophy, and this has served me so much times in my career. Always hope for the upside, but I plan for the downside. I get ready. What if it goes bad? What do? Still working for the upside, but I'm planning for the bad side. Infrastructure. A lot of people want to take the money off the table as quick as they can. I'm a guy that believes in get you a CFO, get you ahead of marketing, get you ahead of this as you're growing your companies. Put money into the company so that you don't have one orange theory. You got 33. And then maybe my biggest thing is setting expectations with employees. We hire people, we hand them a job description, say, here, go. That's not how you handle employees. You sit down, you set expectations, you hold them accountable. Not to be ugly to hold them accountable, but you hold them accountable. And you keep them informed of what's going on and you work with them and you push them as hard as you can. So those are kind of like my business lessons. I like to talk about my life lessons a little bit. You know, education is so important, but in this day and time, it's about a specific education. Don't get a bachelor's degree in art anymore. Find something specific. It's tougher to get jobs nowadays. You need a skill set. Really believe in that. Obviously, with my experience, facing death now 4 times, losing a wife to cancer, lived in the moment. You just do not know what tomorrow will bring, because I can tell you I never did. And then I always ask why not instead of why. Why can't I do that versus why do it? And then I'll leave you with sort of my final little thought, Jay. And it's, you know, resilience just isn't about getting up. Resilience is about finding the way.
Wow, that's awesome. That is so good. I really love that. James, I'll tell you what. I mean, this has been one of the best interviews. I mean, because you've lived it, you've experienced it, you're out there teaching it. And you're doing it because I know you care and you love people. And man, I tell you what, it's just been, I mean, it was great to read your book. And I tell you, I'm honored to know someone like you that, you know, has been there, done that, and is trying to help other people. I know that if I need something, man, I can call you and say, hey, what do you think about this? And it doesn't matter what you're doing. You know, you're playing golf at your Carencia there in Cabo or whatever. I know that you'll give me the time. You'll give me the time and whatever it takes. But I know you're always there for me or anybody else that needs time. So, James, thank you so much for being on today. It's been a great reading your book. It's been great. I'm going to help promote the book. So I want to make sure Redneck Resilience right there to make sure that you download that book. And you feel like you're there. I mean, I feel like that I was sitting in that chair along with him on the majority of those times, because it's just, that's how a book should read, right? You should feel like you're in the moment with them and making sure that, man, you know, I'm right there with them and being transparent and, you know, the moment. I mean, it's not like, well, you know, we built this company. No. It's exactly specifically how we built the company and the relationships and the financing and all that. So what a great job, James. Appreciate that. Thanks for being on.
Now, if you want any more information, Jay, it's www.jamesheraldweb.com.
Jamesheraldweb.com. There you go, man. Thanks a lot. Be balanced. Redneck Resilience. And James, thank you so much. Appreciate it. Have a great time down there, and hope to see you again soon.
Yeah, so value our friendship, brother. Thank you.
Thank you, man. Love you. Take care.